NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Welcome to Fantasy Feud, a pitcherless baseball podcast where we're tackling the most relevant debates in fantasy baseball each week. I'm Sarah Sanchez, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host Shelley Verstrait to talk through both sides of the hottest fantasy baseball debates right now with some of the greatest minds in the industry. It has been a few weeks of fab decisions. I picked up Ryan Stanek, and then I dropped him for Adam Ottavino. I need saves in a bunch of places. Shelley, how are your teams doing?
They're kind of like middle of the pack, which, I mean, it was much better than at the beginning of the season where I was like sitting in like 15 team leagues with like 50 points. And I'm like, how on earth do I make this up? So I've gotten back to the middle of the pack, but I don't know. Recently, Bailey Ober and Pablo Lopez have really let me down. Just like their last starts, I was expecting goodness and I got badness. So it's going all right. Kind of wish I was higher, but at least I'm not last.
Yeah, I have a couple of leagues where things are going pretty well, and then I have Tout Wars where things are going terribly because I have Francisco Lindor and Manny Machado, neither of whom seems to want to play well, anything like their previous iterations of themselves. I'm hoping that just flips the switch at some point. One guy who is definitely destroying me in Tout Wars at the moment is our guest today. We're excited to welcome Derek Van Riper to the show. You know Derek from his excellent work at The Athletic, where he is the co-host of the Rates and Barrels podcast. Welcome to Fantasy Feud, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I think all the credit for my Tout Wars team to this point belongs to Ellie De La Cruz. If I didn't have Ellie, I'd probably be in about 9th or 10th place. So he's been the cheat code so far.
Well, yeah, the steal pace for Ellie. We have not returned to Ellie De La Cruz as one of our debate topics on this show for a while, but we probably should because I've never seen anything like the rate at which that dude has decided he's going to steal bases.
It feels like he has a real chance at 100 steals, which 3 years ago seemed completely impossible in Major League Baseball. And now I'm thinking, okay, Ellie could do it, but then who's going to see Ellie do it and try to match it or beat it? Because that's kind of how things work. And, you know, we're in year two of the new rules where the league made a big adjustment last year and is adjusting even more because the success rate on stolen bases was so high. So I think we're getting closer to the plateau in year two, but Ellie's showing a lot of guys what's actually possible out there right now.
That's so true. And it's not just Ellie. And it really does seem like it's a team by team decision too. One of my most rostered players this year is Bryce Terang, who kind of was out on a limb on, but Terang's running a ton. He's getting on base more than I thought he would. I knew he would play because the glove plays, but he's running a lot. And then another guy who's running way more than I thought he was, who I happen to be looking at player values today because I just got him back on a couple of teams where I really needed him, was Luis Ranjifo, who I never thought would have this type of value through 7 weeks of a season. But here we are, Luis Ranjifo, two more stolen bases last night, and he's just leading off for the Angels and running riot.
Yeah, one of the few good things about the 2024 Angels, the Ron Washington giving everybody the green lights. I mean, we saw Mike Trout running again before the injury too, which I thought was really encouraging. But geez, 12 for 14 from Luis Ranjifo. He's got more steals in 32 games this season, the same total they had in the previous two combined.
Yeah, he's a $10.5 player right now, according to the Fangraphs player rater, which if you got Luis Ranjifo on your team, you're pretty happy about that. Shelley, how are you doing for steals in your leagues?
I mean, the leagues that I have Ellie in, I'm doing completely fine. Other than that, I'm mid-pack. I have Jose Caballero in a couple leagues. I picked him up like late in 15 teamers, which has been nice. He doesn't really give much else other than steals, but he's, you know, helping me along, but I don't know, just as long as I'm staying like mid pack or, I mean, I don't need to win every category. So just as long as I have some and I'm not like desperate for saves, I'm feeling, you know, I feel okay.
I am desperate in a couple of places, and I mostly blame Nico Horner and his not running and whatever's going on with his hamstring. But that is a debate for another day. As you know, the rules of the road for this show, this is a debate podcast. So we're going to work through all of the things that are going on in fantasy baseball right now through some mini debates. The first debater gets 3 minutes to make their case. The second debater gets 3 minutes to make their case. There's a question and answer between the debaters that might be moderator led, but can be questions between the debaters. And then we'll wrap it up with a couple of 1 minute rebuttals. The moderator role will shift throughout, and everybody should get a chance to defend their players throughout the show. It should be pretty fun. We're just going to jump right in to our first debate here. We talked about saves recently on this show and props. If you had Class A or Robert Suarez in your leagues, although Emmanuel Class A got kind of had a bit of an adventure the other night. Today, however, we're going to talk about starting pitchers. And a lot of the guys who are probably winning you your leagues right now did not go in those first two rounds, even after all of the inflation that happened on main event weekend. We're going to talk about some guys who we feel best about rest of season in that grouping that sort of got inflated, but really wasn't in the top maybe seven or eight guys. And I'll moderate this debate between whether you would rather have Tarek Skubal or Tyler Glasnow rest of season, two really interesting arms that also have had some injury issues. And so I think this makes for a nice discussion. Derek is our guest. You get to go first.
Awesome. I think for me, Tyler Glasnow has an edge in the team quality being a lot better. Dodgers versus Tigers. You've got a deeper and better bullpen in this Dodgers team and tons of run support. That's the bigger difference, right? Consistently on a night-to-night basis, Tyler Glasnow's got an offense behind him that's going to put runs on the board. The big thing with Tyler Glasnow going all the way back through draft season, I heard so many people say he never stays healthy. He never stays healthy. And it's not entirely true. Yes, he has had a lot of injuries. Tyler Glasnow has dealt with major injuries. Last year, it was only 120 innings at the big league level, but another 13 and a third rehabbing, working his way back at AAA. If you go further back and you include the years in which he was breaking into the big leagues and even working through the Pirates system, you can find more full seasons from Tyler Glasnow. I think 2017 was his high watermark. It was 155 and a third innings. It was split between AAA and Pittsburgh. And I think of all the things we do in the fantasy community trying to predict injuries, one thing we fail to do consistently well is account for pitcher workloads before they were major league pitchers, and even pitcher injuries before they were major league pitchers. Sometimes that gets lost in the fold too. I think I didn't know off the cuff that Spencer Strider had a Tommy John in college, for example, right? That's the kind of stuff that you don't remember it, or you don't read it or consume it quite the same way, because it didn't happen when those players were in our player pool in the same way. So for me, Tyler Glasnow has always had elite skills, always shown ratios and strikeout rates that you'd expect from a true fantasy ace. And now he's on one of the best, if not the best teams in baseball, and he's healthy right now. And I think if I've learned one thing doing this over the years, that's all that matters on the health front for the most part. Other than guys that have had multiple Tommy Johns already, any pitcher can get hurt at any time. It could be a hammy, it could be an oblique, it could be any of those things that Glasnow's already dealt with. He's healthy right now. He's got everything you're looking for in a true frontline starter, and he's got that team behind him. So to me, it's like the things I hoped for during draft season, they're happening so far through 10 starts. And I'm just expecting another 20 starts that are just as good as what we've seen so far.
Awesome. That's the case for Tyler Glasnow. Shelley, you've got Tarek Skubal in this one, and your time starts now.
Yeah, I've been a fan of Skubal ever since I saw him play AA Richmond in 2019. I fell in love. I mean, that's when he totally like blew up all the prospect list. Like in AA that year, he had a 21.7% swinging strike rate. It was absolutely phenomenal. But I've been a fan of his since then. It's been a crazy up and down road. It has, I mean, Glasnow had the ups and downs as well, but I think Skubal had like the smaller floor, whatever. So he had a bigger floor, right? What he's doing this year, he's just impressed me so much. 55 innings, a 1.8 ERA, a 0.78 whip. What I've been impressed with the most whenever I've watched him is his ability to throw strikes. He has a first pitch strike percentage of 72%. And yeah, that can fluctuate with any start, right? If he doesn't have the feel for all of his pitches, yeah, that's going to come down a little bit. But that is the highest mark that I see from a major league season. So he is just throwing it right down right down Broadway and saying, hit it. He doesn't seem scared. He doesn't seem flustered by anything. He's just like, I know that you are not going to be able to hit this, so I'm going to throw it down there. Derek is right that Glasnow obviously is on the better team, but what Glasnow has, what, 6 wins? Yeah, he's 6-0 out of 9 starts. That's a pretty good ratio. Obviously, he's going to lose some because that's just how things work. But I mean, even going over to Fangraphs and their AL Cy Young predictor thing, he is definitely leading the AL by a lot. By what, like 19 points over Corbin Burns. And then if you just go down to the National League, he's definitely beating Sale, Wheeler, Shota, and then Glasnow. So, well, you know, that's just projections, right? I would still put my money on Scoobal because, I don't know, I just trust him more. Yeah, we've seen Glasnow be elite, but I'm sorry. I'm just gonna throw that injury card. I mean, I hope that doesn't happen. I mean, Scoobal has his injuries as well, but if I had to put my money where my mouth is, it's definitely with Scoobal.
It's interesting. The team context could not be more different, right? Like we're looking at another really great Tiger starter who has almost, I don't think he has any wins at the moment, in Reese Olson, who is another breakout player, just cannot get a win to save his life, right? So that luck can shift on a dime and Tarek Skubal could find himself in that position. But I liked Skubal a little bit more this draft season than Glasnow. And Derek, I'm curious what your thoughts are on this, because I know you've been really high on Glasnow. The way the Dodgers manage their pitching drives me crazy. I honestly just trust the Tigers to let Tarek Skubal take the ball and throw it no matter what. Whereas the Dodgers, I'm just not sure on a given day, especially with, you know, they've got Kershaw coming back from injury. They've got the 6-man questions with Yamamoto. Do you worry that Glasnow is just not going to get the volume he needs?
It's always possible. The Dodgers will quietly go into 6-man rotations from time to time, and that chips away at workloads a little bit. But when you break the math down, you're talking usually about 15, maybe 20 innings at most. And they do it, of course, because they have aspirations of playing for a World Series. You want to keep these guys as fresh as possible. I keep looking at their depth this year and wondering if they just don't have the luxury this time around. It's going to be relying on guys like Eliezer Hernandez and Ryan Yarbrough for more innings than it's going to be going internal with some of the prospects, because they've stacked up a ton of injuries. I mean, losing Emmett Sheehan, possibly not getting Clayton Kershaw back. That's kind of an open question. Like, maybe he's back in the second half, but maybe we don't see him pitch at all. Guys like May and Gonsolin, they're far away at this point. So there's a lot of questions about how much they can pull back on guys like Glasnow or even Yoshinobu Yamamoto. So I'm a slight concern about the workload, but I think the injury risk in this case, Glasnow versus Skubal, totally even for me. I would give them the same slightly below average or well below average health grade. If we want to say it's an A to F scale, they're probably C minus D plus health guys right now. But I think it fluctuates so fast on the pitching side that you can have a low health grade for a couple of seasons, stay healthy for one or two, like Pablo Lopez has, and all of a sudden you're in that A or B group. I think Zach Wheeler is another guy like that. During his time with the Mets, elevated injury risk, had a Tommy John, finally got to this point, and now he's a workhorse, right? So I think you could see both of these guys actually kind of make that move out of the injury-prone bucket in the next couple of seasons.
Yeah, it's a great point. Shelley, I'm curious for you, since you took the Skubal side of this, you mentioned that Skubal has injury concerns as well. I look at the two of these guys, and I wonder, Tarek Skubal is throwing gas right now. I mean, not that Glasnow is not, but we've seen all of the correlations about how hard you throw your fastball and injury, and Skubal is like the one guy who's still healthy. And I just wonder, do you worry about the fact that he's just got the tiny bit more velocity that could result in an injury, or are you more looking at the track record with Glasnow?
I mean, for me, from a keeper standpoint, yes, it does scare me. For this year, no. I think, I mean, obviously anyone can get hurt at any time, but at least for like redraft, I really don't look into that in season too much, because you can like really just nitpick at just every little thing and get scared off about everybody. So I fully believe in Scooble. And then with Glass now, it doesn't, I mean, I know he has a Tommy John on his register, but he also like leaves games with like, cramping in his hand, what I just think is odd. So he has like these weird things. And at least with Scooble, he does have a TJ. He had a TJ in college. And then he had like that, it was like a, I think it was like a flexor thing in his arm that caused him to miss half of last season. So yeah, long-term, it does concern me. This year, I have too many other things to worry about than possibly Scooble breaking and making me cry.
I hadn't heard the Glasnow cramping thing, and that actually reminds me of the sticky stuff enforcement, because I believe Glasnow was out there as being like, oh, this has actually changed my the way I grip the ball, and I can feel it like a week before he had Tommy John, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
Great stuff from both of you. Honestly, they're both excellent pitchers, and you probably got them depending on when you were drafting in the third or fourth round, and you're sitting pretty because you've got two guys who went in the early rounds. You've got the right answers. I'm going to turn it over to 1 minute rebuttals, and we'll start with you, DBR.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Scooble, it's impressive that he's changed so much with his control over the years, because now we're talking about a 2 year window where he's had a walk rate under 5%. And usually you don't get walk rates that low with strikeout rates that high. And I think that's like the skills growth that I didn't expect. As he's also a tinkerer. He messes with his pitch mix a lot. So I like guys that do that, especially guys that can still throw hard, because it just gives them more ways to confuse hitters, more ways to be really good. I think the other thing that I didn't bring up before, though, with Glasnow, he has probably the best individual pitch of these two guys. His curveball will grade out as probably the best pitch that either one of these two guys has. So if you're splitting hairs on two guys that are really, really similar, give me the guy that has the absolute best weapon in his arsenal that he can go to. I think that gives him just a slightly, slightly higher floor. But I think Shelley made a lot of great points about Scooble. And the thing that I continue to be impressed by with him, besides the control, a 78.1% zone contact percentage. So he's in the zone and guys can't hit it, like she said.
It's a great point on the individual pitches, although, and I only know this because I was looking up some stuff with Shota Imanaga earlier this week, and I believe Glasnow has one of the filthiest four-seam fastballs in the league, too, by run value. So you're happy if you have either of these aces. Shelley, your minute rebuttal.
Yeah, exactly what you said. You're not upset with any of these two. I mean, I have Pablo Lopez on some teams, and while, you know, the strikeouts are great, the ERA is quite icky. You know, I have Spencer Strider in one league, so that kind of sinks too. But these guys are both great. I don't know. Maybe I'm just too far on the East Coast and I watch too much Tigers games versus Dodgers games, but I don't know. I watch a lot of Scooble's games and I just see it. Like, he's not fazed by anything. And I love that. And I see it in the numbers. I see everything. So maybe I just need to watch. Maybe I need to stay up later and watch more Dodgers games to get the full Tyler Glasnow effect. But yeah, just give me Scooble for this year.
I will defend the process that led to me taking Spencer Strider second overall in Tout Wars till the end. Even though it didn't work out, I did get something like $555 back from that, because in Tout Wars, we have Fab redemption if you lose a guy at a certain point of the year. So hopefully we'll be able to turn that into some players to kind of sort of make up for it later. Both of these guys have been great. According to the Fangraphs player rater, Tarek Skubal has been worth $34.7 so far, and go just a tiny bit down to Tyler Glasnow, who's been worth $30.2. You will take a $30 pitcher in the first four rounds any day. I am going to turn the moderating duties, I believe, over to DVR.
Yeah, so we're going to keep it going on the hitter side, staying with the Fangraphs player rater. We're going to talk about a couple of Phillies thriving right now. Alec Bohm and Bryson Stott. Sarah, you are on the Alec Bohm side. We'll give you the floor first.
Listen, y'all, one of the columns that I write that I love writing is the Playing Time Tomorrow column for the NL East over at Baseball HQ. And so I've been kind of watching what's been going on with Alec Bohm for the better part of two seasons now, right? Because the thing I think we need to be really aware of with Alec Bohm is that this breakout started in about July of last year. A couple of things jump out at me right away. If you compare Bryson Stott and Alec Bohm's pair play on Baseball Savant, you're going to get a bunch of like that deep red that you love on their player cards, but Bohm's got more of it. All of the expected stats are where you want to be for Alec Bohm. He's doing the things that are not necessarily where you want them to be are still pretty good, like a 56% barrel rate, and he's got a decent amount of bat speed. So what we're seeing now is really going on a full season of Alec Bohm just being an exceptional hitter. And I ran the numbers over at FanGraphs, if I can find the right tab, because you know how it goes when you've got 9 million tabs up. I ran the numbers going back to July 1st of last year. They're right next to each other back to back. Bryson Stott's played 118 games since then. Alec Bohm has played 124. You're looking at 477 plate appearances for Stott, and you're looking at 529 for Bohm. The bottom line is that Bohm has been the better hitter by WRC plus, and it's not particularly close. He's got a WRC plus of 132 during that time frame to Stott's 117. Don't get me wrong, both of these guys are great, and you're getting a little bit more speed with Stott. But I think that what Alec Bohm is doing should not be seen as a fluke. It should be seen as an actual change that he made somewhere towards the midpoint last season. And so I'm just going to take those runs and RBIs, the more plate appearances, a 14.2% strikeout rate, and a 7.9% walk rate all day. He is hitting .297 in those 529 plate appearances. And frankly, that's 26 points of batting average over Alec Bohm that are important when you're making decisions for your fantasy team.
Shelley, for the Stott side?
Yeah. I don't know. I've been really impressed with Stott. Last year I had him and I was just kind of like, I liked the steals and that was fine. I just wanted more. So I unfortunately ended up with him, quote unquote, unfortunately ended up with him in a couple of rotor leagues. And I've been like, oh, this is the guy who I thought I was getting last year. Yeah, he's hitting .279, .393, .456 with 5 homers and 12 steals. What I've been impressed with is his power, his slugging. So he's obviously slugging .456. This is the highest outside of, you know, a 9-game sample in AAA in 2022. And then we go back to a larger sample size, which was a 481 slug in AA. And you have to keep in mind the AA Phillies affiliate is Reading, and that anyone basically can hit a homer out of that park. So this is honestly, I think, the biggest power spike that we've seen from Stott. So his game is all coming together. He's still running. He already has 12 swipes. And the power is coming. And, you know, you look at his line drive, ground ball, fly ball, it's all the same as last year. But what surprises me is maybe we can get a little bit higher average than the .279. He currently has a .295 BABIP. And with that speed and the same, you know, ground ball, line drive, fly ball trajectory, you would think that that BABIP's going to come up a little bit. So maybe we can get closer to 300 with like 15, 20 homers and, you know, 30 steals. That would be absolutely fantastic. So if I had to take one of these guys again, it would definitely be Stott, just because Bohm's not going to give you steals. So at least it's all coming together for Stott.
So my first question for Shelley with Stott is, do you think he can increase the quality of the contact? Because the only thing that jumps off the page for me, like, why doesn't he hit for a higher average? It's a low hard hit rate so far, but it's lower than it was. So like, who is he in terms of the quality of contact that he makes?
That's fair. That's totally fair. I do think that he can come up like a little bit. Again, he's not going to wow you with the power numbers. I think that, you know, he could just, you know, get a lot of doubles and maybe run out some singles. You know, that BABIP is kind of low. I'm expecting him to get a little bit better with just getting like singles, right? you know, beating out some plays right there. So yeah, maybe I'm just getting like too hung up on the higher slugging and the five homers already. So maybe 10 homers, right? But I'll be fine with that. I don't know. I just love his game. It's really very impressive.
Yeah, he's part of this group of players. I mean, Andrés Giménez has kind of similar skills. Nico Horner doesn't quite have the same power ceiling, but I think Ha-Seong Kim maybe is in this group too. Mm-hmm. You wonder, like, in a good year, what is the power ceiling like? In that ballpark, I think that helps Bryson's stock quite a bit. Sarah, the question I have for you with Bohm is, if he's not going to steal bases, he probably has to hit 20-plus homers again to sustain consistent shallow league value, right? If you hit 15 homers, even with great run production, it's a weird player to roster, right? It's kind of like a typical good year for you, like a Yandy Diaz. It works, but you have to find those homers somewhere else. Do you think Bohm will unlock more power than we saw in 2023, given the quality of contact he makes?
Yeah, a couple of things going on here. One, he is just slightly off track for 20 home runs this year. And I think that that's one of those numbers that you want to look at the weather as much as anything, right? Like having five home runs at this point in May when you play in a Northeast ballpark probably means that you've got 15 home runs left in your bat between May and August, September when you play in Philadelphia. Like I'm actually not that worried about Bohm getting to that power. But the thing that I really like about Bohm, and you know, you were talking about his quality of contact, I think that the batting average is going to come back to his more career level. He's currently hitting 330 this season, which is bonkers. And it's built off a pretty unsustainable 366 BABIP that's just not in line with anything that he has done in previous iterations of himself. But he's hitting the ball hard. He's barreling the ball. And I do think that that probably means that the power will increase as the batting average comes down a bit. And so you're looking at a guy who's going to hit you like, I don't know, 280, 290 doesn't seem outside of the realm of possibility, and you get 20 home runs from that. I feel pretty good about that, where he hits in the Phillies lineup. I also like that he's corner eligible. I think that there's been kind of a run on corner guys at the moment where it's really hard to replace people. Like I have Noelvi Marte in a couple of leagues where I draft, that was the guy I drafted there. Or I was really big on Jamer Candelario. I was sure that Great American Ballpark was just going to work out so well for Candelario, Spencer Sears day to day. You've got a bunch of guys in that corner position that it's really hard to fill right now. If you thought Jose Abreu was going to be your answer there, he's not. And it's probably not, there's probably not somebody readily available on your waiver wire to replace them with. So I like the corner eligibility from Bohm. I like the batting average with the power. I like the quality of contact a little bit more. That is all too say, I think Bryson Stott's a really good player. And frankly, this Phillies team has been super impressive to me this season. They look better than the Atlanta Braves right now. And I didn't think I'd be saying that in April.
Yeah. I wonder how much of that is Ronald Acuna Jr. just not looking right. Like a lot of questionable clips that I've seen from Acuna so far this season. The only other question I had for Shelley on Bryson Stott is the walk rate going through the roof this year, 14.9% so far. Where does that number fall the rest of the way? Because if he has skills like that, he's a table setter for a great lineup, and that changes a lot. If he goes back to the walk rates we saw last year and during his rookie season, he probably moves up and down the lineup a bit. Maybe against righties, he hits higher. Against lefties, he drops down. Who knows? But how much do you trust that skill?
Can I say I semi-trust it? I mean, like looking back throughout like his minor league career, it's always been pretty high. But again, like he was always like an advanced hitter coming up through the minors. And, you know, I really don't look too much into walk rates in like low A for someone like Stott, because I just always believed in his ability to put the bat on the ball. And obviously pitchers in that league can't necessarily throw strikes consistently. So, I kind of believe more of what his walk rates were in 2022 and 2023. But I do think it could be better than that. So maybe he'll settle down to like 9-10%. I don't think he'll get back to the low of last year, which was like 6%. I don't think he's going to fall that far off. And, you know, he's sitting at like 15% right now. So that would be a drastic drop. So, yeah, I think it's going to come down a bit. But I think it's going to be better than the last two seasons.
All right, Sarah, 1 minute rebuttal if you want it.
I mean, these are both really good players. And depending on what your needs are, you're probably happy to have either of them. Shelley's absolutely right that you're going to get more stolen bases from Stott. I just think the actual approach at the plate and the power skills that Boehm has exhibited are not, they're not a recent fluke. Like, this is something that is going to, that has been evident in his profile for at least one season now, and you can kind of see shades of it back in 2022. So I believe a little bit more in what Alec Boehm is doing. Both of them are great, and you'd be happy to have either one on your team.
1 minute to you, Shelley.
Yeah, I like both players. And then, like with Sarah's comment about the Phillies being better than the Braves, it kind of makes me want to say Trey Turner, who, right? Because it's like, it's really funny how well they're doing without Trey Turner. But anyway, going back to the debate at hand, from a Roto perspective, I definitely would rather have Stott because he's going to give you the stolen bases. He's going to give you a decent enough average, and he's not going to be an absolute zero in power. So you're going to get like a whole full circle of production versus what Boehm can do, which is not give you steals.
Yeah, I think the ceiling for Boehm, unless he unlocks more power, is in that more in that Yandy range. But if you were to find a way to get to more power, then you could dream on some Corey Seager type peak seasons with the average running where it is right now. That just seems a little out of reach based on what we've seen over the course of his career.
Yeah, I think that both of these guys are super interesting. And also, what is going on in Philadelphia? I hope you drafted some Phillies, because the Phillies offense is just a well-oiled machine. One thing, the question didn't come to me, but I think another thing that might be going on here with the Phillies is their pitching has been out of this world to start the season. Ranger Suarez looks like one of the three best pitchers in the league. And that's, you know, plus Zach Wheeler and plus Aaron Nola and plus what they got from Spencer Turnbull. It's just been kind of a perfect, perfect collision of great baseball for the Phillies. And I'm happy for them. We're going to talk about a team that is dealing with not that perfect collision of hitting and pitching at the moment. And I believe that Shelley is moderating this debate.
Yeah, we're going to go up north. And talk about some park effects. You know, park effects, we kind of look at it like a 3-year, like rolling window, rolling average, because they're quite noisy. But, you know, I don't know. The Blue Jays, while on paper, have, you would think that they would be better than they were, but they're giving me like, what, 2021, 2022 White Sox vibes. Maybe not to the same extent, but it's like, oh, on paper, the offense looks stack, chef's kiss, awesome. And then you look at their production and you're like, wait, what's going on? So we're going to debate this out. Is it the park? Is it the players? What is it? We're going to go with Sarah first.
So I was looking at this a little bit in the offseason because there were rumors that the Cubs might be in on Matt Chapman. I thought that Matt Chapman was one of the most confusing players last offseason to look at. He had like 100th percentile hard hit rate. He was absolutely smashing the ball and he was not seeing any results for it, which is just kind of infuriating. And then it got me thinking about the fact that he's not the only Blue Jays hitter who in the last couple of years, since they've started messing around with the wall and with the foul poles and the this and the that at the Rogers Center, has really disappointed us, right? Like Vladito is a guy that we are like, where's the 40 home runs? All the projection systems think there should be 40 home runs, and there's not 40 home runs, and it doesn't look like it's coming back. He's hitting the ball in such a way that he is not getting that type of effect. And so then I started going back into the data a little bit more. And honestly, the last time the Blue Jays looked like the mashing team that could really dates back to when they were playing their games at their AAA affiliate and in Dunedin, not when they were playing their games in the renovated Rogers Center. And so part of me wonders, maybe these are the same guys. Maybe they've got the same approach, or, you know, slightly different here or there. Obviously, Bo Bichette's got some struggles that are a little bit different than whatever is going on with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. or whatever is going on with Matt Chapman. All of these are different players who approach the ball differently and approach playing differently. But it does seem to me that the Blue Jays have made some structural changes to the Rogers Center that have made their hitters worse. And when I look at park effects, yes, we usually look at 3-year rolling park factors, and that's important because things can change so so much, but it's a little bit misleading when one of the years that's in the park factors includes changes that aren't being accounted for. And so on the 3-year rolling park factors, the Blue Jays park looks like it should be, it's the 12th best park to hit in overall. It's got a park factor of exactly 100. It should be a plus park for home runs with a 105 factor for home runs. It should be a plus park for doubles with a 108 park factor. And then you kind of pull that toggle off and you look at it just for 2024 and you wind up seeing a park that plays a little bit differently. It's the 20th best park to hit in. It's a 98 park factor. It's good for singles and it's still good for doubles, but the home run factor goes all the way down to 91 and the strikeout factor goes up. And so I am real concerned that the Blue Jays might have actually played themselves here and created a worse hitting environment for their sluggers, and we're seeing the effects of it.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched many Blue Jays games, and while like the stadium looks amazing, I would love to catch a game there, grab a beer. It looks like a phenomenal place to watch a game. But yeah, I remember having Chapman in a couple leagues last year, and his hard hit rate was crazy, but he was just basically like hitting it up the middle, and it would just like die like right at the fence, basically. DVR, over to you.
So I thought the park was at least a factor that slowed down the entire Jays offense last year. It's not just that, though. I mean, you can see it. If you look at their road numbers as a team, the Blue Jays were 5th in WRC plus on the road last year. They were a 111. So they were behind Atlanta, Houston, Tampa Bay, and the Dodgers. So top 5 offense by WRC plus away. And to Sarah's point, the ballpark, just flipping it to the home WRC plus, 103. So they were worse, but kind of like a league average team at home. So there's definitely something in play there. But the bigger concern for me is that I think some of this is approach. With Matt Chapman, because of his age, you can ask a question of, did he lose bat speed? Is he letting the ball travel because he can't pull it in the air anymore? Or is somebody in his ear telling him to drive it up the middle and try and use that part of the field? Now that he's in San Francisco, we're still having the same conversations about Matt Chapman through the first 2 months of this season. There are glimmers of hope. If you look at X stats versus actual results, the X stats say that Matt Chapman should be better. He still isn't that guy yet. And I don't know if he's going to get back to being that guy. But my question for everybody is, like, why is Davis Schneider the best hitter on this team right now? How is that happening? Like, it just, that doesn't make any sense. Vlad Jr. has 4 homers in 46 games. Like, a 128 WRC plus, that's not bad, but that's not the Vlad Jr. we were promised. He should be right in that peak window where he's one of the best hitters in the league. Dalton Varsho is another guy that underperforms on balls in play. Some of it's that he's a pull fly ball guy, which is good because if you can pull your barrels, you get rewarded for that. But even Dalton Varsho runs offensive numbers, at least in his slash line, they're lower than you'd expect for a player with his skills. Somehow, the Blue Jays have broken Justin Turner. Maybe age has caught up to him finally. He's been such a good player for such a long time. He's below average by WRC plus for the first time in his career. Bo Bichette has an 81 WRC plus overall. Why doesn't Bo Bichette do more damage? I've been wondering for over a year what's going on with him. And I think some of it with Bo Bichette is that he's always been more of an opposite field hitter. So I think some of it is an organizational philosophy, either in the types of players they're choosing or within the coaching staff, not getting guys to lift and pull the ball consistently enough to tap into their power. Because Bo and Vlad Jr. in particular are consistent underperformers. And even, geez, George Springer should be one of those simple metronome players. He's their worst regular by WRC plus, 3 homers in 42 games. So I think there's something more going on than just the ballpark, because the power outage has impacted so many players and a lot of these guys have different approaches and it's hurt everybody in different ways.
Yeah, those are like really interesting points. And what, I mean, there was something that Kevin Gausman said, I think after his last start, like the team kind of rushed him back. He was like, oh, well, I kind of wanted to come back too, but from his shoulder injury. So I think it's just a combination of just a lot of things. I mean, they didn't sign like too many big free agents. Manoah has been so up and down and they can't really quite, it took him a while for him to get right. You know, the whole Gausman thing, just, I don't know, seems kind of odd, but so any rebuttals?
I think Sarah's on mute.
Yep. I'm not anymore, though. I muted myself because I had an ambulance going by and I didn't want to pull a Todd Zola, as he mentioned on the show last week. And then I forgot I was on mute. I want to go back to the David Schneider part of this discussion for 1 second, because I think he's fascinating. But I also think that he's an example of how the park has forced players to have a very particular approach if they're going to succeed in the park. He's an extreme pull side hitter. He pulls the ball like 16% more than I think Vlad Guerrero Jr. was the player comparison that I was going to. And so, yeah, he's hitting some home runs in the Rogers Center and he's striking out more than you would want him to, because he's just like, that's what he does. Like, this is what David Schneider does. It's great for my team in the first pitch Arizona Rookie League. It's probably not great for the Blue Jays player development overall. Like, David Schneider, love you. I think the look and the stash and everything is great, but also, like, I'm not sure that that's who you want to be the future of your franchise. You really need the Vladimir Guerrero Juniors and the Bo Bichettes of the world to hit. To go back to the Matt Chapman part of this for just 1 second, I honestly think that Matt Chapman landing in San Francisco might have been the worst thing that could have happened to him, because if we're going to talk about park effects, one of the only parks he could have gone to that is worse for all the things that Matt Chapman does than the Rogers Center right now is San Francisco. It has a worse park effect in single or triple years than all of what you get at the Rogers Center. So agreed on Matt Chapman, but maybe it is a player development thing in conjunction with the park, but I do think something is going on with the actual park there, because I don't know about y'all. I used to think of Toronto as a place that I didn't want my pitchers to pitch, and I don't think that anymore.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It used to be an easy avoid, and now I'm pushing that threshold a little bit as far as some of the mid-pack starters that I'll actually toss out there against the Jays. I'm also surprised to see a 344 slugging percentage for the Blue Jays on the road this year. If it was only their home park, I feel like we'd get a better, even a league average is closer to like a 380. I'd settle for a 380. And maybe, again, player selection. Some of the guys they have in the bottom of that lineup are brutal, but it's not just those guys dragging it down. That's the part that confuses me so much. They just don't seem to have a plan that fits their skills. I've wondered for a few years now if Vlad Jr. is almost cursed by the quality of his hit tool. He can hit pitches that are low and away, so he chases at those because they're strikes, instead of working the count more for something up in the zone that he can lift and drive. It's stuff like that, right? And I don't know if it's that he wants to hit his way or if there's nobody out there telling him some other way to go about it, but they've become an underperforming, frustrating team when they looked like they could have been, at least offensively, the next Astros, that team that crushes you and doesn't strike out. That's what they looked like they were going to be about 3 years ago, and we just haven't seen it.
It's interesting that I agree with you on Vladito, by the way. I think that what he does with the way that he reaches out of the zone sometimes is part of why he has that ground ball issue that has hurt his power a little bit. I do wonder, and I don't have an answer for this because I've never done a deep dive on it, so this is going to be like a table, this, and it will be part of a rebuttal another day. I think when you have a park that is playing differently than you thought it was going to play, it can impact the way that you approach the ball. Like, that all of these hitters could be trying to search for something because they're like, this shouldn't be this way. I should be able to hit that ball out. I should be able to do this thing. And it is notable that the one guy who is having success on this team is the guy that just came in with the craziest pull side sellout hit tool, and everybody else is trying to adapt their way out of it and failing. I think that qualifies as my rebuttal. I don't know if we're in the question answer period or the rebuttal period. Sometimes our debates just kind of like wind up where they wind up.
They're just not the team we thought they were. That's where I'm at with them. I'm not expecting the 2021, 2022 Jays to come parachuting in anytime soon.
Yeah, I think that is the takeaway here. We are well overdue for a commercial break for our sponsors, because these were just such great debates that I forgot to hit the pause button a couple of debates ago. But that's okay. We're going to come back. On the flip side, we have three more great debates for you. We also have our Love It or Leave It. Don't go anywhere.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partners. NetCredit, credit to the people.
Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you got to check out NexGard Plus, ofoxaconazole, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease. Plus, it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious beef-flavored, soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 5. South Dakota seemed like the perfect place to unplug, but I ended up connecting to the world around me, a world where each sunset was painted, where I felt adventures pulse with every step, and where cold water trickling, pine swaying, and grunting bison became my favorite soundtracks. I just wish I didn't have to leave. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm getting married today. I'm also a firefighter and first responder. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can make it to my ceremony to start the next chapter of my life.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
We are back. We have already debated the Phillies. We are going to pick it up now with the Rays. And this is a throwback to a debate that we started a couple of weeks ago, but we've got some more information now, so we wanted to revisit it. Pick your Rays outfielder, y'all. We love the Rays prospects. We hate the way they deploy them playing time side. They're extremely platoon heavy and have done some frustrating things, at least for us as fantasy players. So the question of the day that we're returning to today is, which non-full-time player are you more interested in for playing time reasons for the remainder of the season? Between Richie Palacios or Johnny DeLuca. And Shelley, you can start.
Yeah, I don't know who I picked the first time, to be honest, but I'm going to go with Richie Palacios, so I hope I pick the same guy. But anyway, for me, it's Richie Palacios. What I like about him, obviously, is his production so far. He's hitting 258, 357, 383. That's great. But he's also playing second base. I mean, Brandon Lau just came back, so that might end. But heck, right now he has second base and outfield eligibility. That is amazing in 15 teamers. I like the increase in fly balls. That's great. He went to driveline over the winter, and we can see some of the just put the ball in the air. We're seeing some of the stuff that he worked on over the winter. We're starting to see it. And I just think that the Rays, they love flexibility. So I think that Palacios might get more playing time going forward because he can play two different spots. Johnny DeLuca, I mean, obviously he can play any of the outfield positions, but he's not going to come in on the dirt. I liked both coming into DCs. I have a lot of them on DC, so I've been loving it. But I don't know, I wish the Rays would get rid of some of these periphery guys that we've been talking about for 3, 4, 5 years, it seems like, that they're just hanging around, and they just they gobble up the playing time, and it's really frustrating for these guys that they have shown some interesting roto skills like power, speed, decent average, just what you like. So if I had to pick one, it's going to be Richie Palacios, but because we're both talking about race players, we'll probably both be wrong, and it'll be some other outfielder.
Guy we don't even have on the rundown today. Richie Palacios is Shelley's fighter for the Rays. DVR, what about you?
I'll take Johnny DeLuca. It's really tough because Palacios' versatility makes him the kind of player that the Rays can lean on a little more heavily. Plus, given their platoon tendencies, he's a lefty, DeLuca's a righty. So that's the angle, if they're both in the roster, that I think favors Palacios from a pure playing time perspective. My interest is definitely with both. I prefer DeLuca right now because we've seen a more interesting power and speed combination from him throughout his time as a professional, right? He's a little old, or was a little old for all of his stops, because he was a college guy who came through, lost his 2020, and then kind of got, hey, I'm 22 at A ball. Like, that's never a good way to start. You're not going to impress a lot of people beating up on younger competition like that. But he's been an efficient base stealer. He's shown in-game power. He's shown patience. And even with the caveat that he's been old for his eight, for his level everywhere he's played, Johnny DeLuca has never struck out 20% of the time at any level for even a partial season. So there's really nice bat to ball skills here. I do think one of the positions where the Rays tend to not want to mix and match as much is center field. DeLuca can play center field. And I think this almost comes down to some weird question of, do they like DeLuca enough to say, we're done with Jose Siri? Jose Siri is a great defensive player. He has tools. He just doesn't seem to have much of a hit tool. Do they make that swap? Because that's the best path DeLuca has to playing more than Richie Palacios. So I think it's super close. Like Shelley, I'm very worried about some other player being the actual correct answer, given how heavily I've added these players to my rosters, going all the way back to draft and hold season.
Yeah, the playing time question is an interesting one. And just while the two of you were hashing that out a little bit, I ran some numbers since May 1st. I don't think this is going to shock either one of you, but Richie Palacios and Johnny DeLuca are back-to-back. They have both played 17 games. You've got 58 plate appearances for Palacios, 54 for DeLuca. The stat lines actually look pretty similar until you get to some of the results. And then right there at the bottom, the guys who are taking playing time from them, I mean, you can see it. You've got Harold Ramirez, 12 games, 36 plate appearances. Jose Siri, 10 games, 32 plate appearances. Both of whom are struggling. I'm curious, DVR, my question for you, you mentioned Jose Siri. Do you think that Siri is putting up the types of numbers that either get him, probably, I don't know what they could trade him for right now, given the numbers he's got, but at least get the Rays to cut bait?
Yeah, I think it's gone bad enough for a long enough period of time where they could DFA him and just let somebody else claim him off waivers or make a minor trade to just let him go. And it, look, you're not going to change the future of your franchise most likely in the return for Jose Siri, but you might get more than nothing, which I think is good. He's been a below replacement level player so far. I think if we were going to see signs of growth from him with the run of playing time he was given last year, the K rate would be ticking in the right direction, and it's not. It's going the wrong direction. He's at a 38.9% strikeout rate for the season. He's not doing the kind of damage he was last year either. So I think there's this player type, Brenton Doyle's like this in Colorado, where you can be a great defender. As long as you get into your power, teams are going to give you a lot of runway to see what you can do. And I think we're closing in on 1,000 career plate appearances now for Jose Siri. That seems to be the magic number where most teams say, okay, we kind of think you are what you are at this point. That's where I think they're going to be willing to move on from Siri. I mean, maybe they can hide him as a backup center fielder on the roster, but it's hard to have a player like this when you wouldn't even really want to use him as a pinch hitter late in games. And he doesn't fit their organizational profile. That type of swing and miss isn't normally what you find in a Rays project player.
No, it's a great point. Shelley, you mentioned the positional versatility, and you also mentioned how Richie Palacios might just fit the way the Rays tinker a bit more. Bless Jason Martinez over at Fangraphs trying to figure out the Rays roster on any given day, because he's currently got Richie Palacios as part of a strong side platoon. He's got Johnny DeLuca as a regular, as an everyday player, but I'm not sure. I mean, they've literally played basically the same number of games, similar number of at-bats, all of those types of things. My question for you is, Richie Palacios sometimes to me looks like a guy who is a better real life player than a fantasy player, which is usually the type of thing that the Rays really like. That also makes me want to roster Johnny DeLuca. Do you agree that Richie Palacios might just be the better real life baseball player, but maybe that doesn't help us as fantasy players?
I mean, that really could be. Honestly, if I have to admit, that's kind of like one of my faults when it comes to fantasy baseball. I always say that I kind of go the Cleveland Guardians route. I always struggle with power. I'm all about hit tool. So I get it. I really get what the Rays are doing. But I think what we have seen so far from Palacios and the work that he's done, I think that we can see this level of power and steals going forward as long as he gets the playing time. So I think that it's there. I do love Johnny DeLuca. What really intrigued me when they traded for him, he kind of has like an Isak Paredes kind of thing. He pulls his fly balls, which I absolutely loved and picked him up in a lot of DCs just because of that. I'm like, oh, they saw it work with Paredes, so they're trying it with DeLuca. And maybe DVR will be right, and it's going to be DeLuca going forward just because he's going to hit that power ceiling, like a higher ceiling than Palacios. I just like just everything that Palacios does.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with any of that. We can move to 1 minute rebuttals if y'all have them. DVR, we'll start with you.
Don't really have much on this one. I mean, I think there's a world where they both play. There's a world where they both don't. The other factor in all this is Brandon Lau. I think he's finally trending toward being healthy again. I think if Brandon Lau's healthy, they like playing Brandon Lau at second base more than they like playing him in the outfield. That just takes away one of the ways that Palacios can play. But hey, you could play these guys right next to each other in the outfield and it would make me happy.
And you can bat them right next to each other in the lineup as the Rays have been doing. Shelley, your 1 minute rebuttal.
Yeah, both of these players are great, especially in like daily leagues. Yes, because if you could take them in and out and just go with the Rays, you know, that's great. Weekly leagues, it's going to be more frustrating. You have to look at matchups, you have to look at trends, and then you'll probably end up being frustrated at some point because Tampa's going to Tampa. But both of these players are great. If you have them in these deeper leagues, you're singing their praises.
Yeah, it's a great point about daily versus weekly leagues because most of the leagues that I'm playing in this year for my own personal sanity are weekly leagues. And these players have been frustrating there. But in a daily league move, I can just, DeLuca's not in the lineup. I throw someone else there. That's a great point as well. We're going to move to a couple of different guys who are playing the outfield. And we could not have DVR on the show without doing a Brewers debate. So the Astros have been disappointing, but Jake Meyers has not been disappointing. I'm going to set the stage here for a second that we're going to keep this to redraft for right now because the question, I think, in Dynasty Leagues is pretty obvious. But after Sunday's games, Meyers is hitting 302, 368, 552 with 5 home runs and 2 stolen bases. Would you rather roster him or stick with Jackson Churio on the Brewers, where you've got a potentially star prospect over there in Milwaukee? And DVR, we'll start with you.
Yeah, so for me, this is the type of thing you hate to have to decide on because 2 months ago, it would have been Churio for, I think, anybody, hands down. It's like, hey, let's see what he can do. Let's put him out there and let's hope that he can run wild, get to some power, even if he hurts us in batting average. That's fine. We can live with it because the payoff could be massive if it all clicks right away. I think it's very hard in today's major league landscape to have grounded expectations for any rookie player. And I think we saw it with Jackson Holliday, the quick demotion back to AAA. We've seen it with plenty of other players. I was thinking about this maybe 2 weeks ago. Bobby Witt Jr., when he debuted, got the opening day assignment a couple of years ago. He had his worst month of the entire rookie season in his first month. And it's not a surprise. And I know we're moving through the second month now. We're late into May. Many top prospects, when they come up, they're going to have their worst month of their rookie season in the first month. They're adapting to much better pitching. The gap between AAA and the big leagues is huge. Churio barely spent time at AAA. He had 6 games there at the end of last season. And the Brewers still felt good enough to give him that big contract, which over time might look like a huge bargain for them, right? I think the only reason I would even in a redraft league, I would be a little bit skeptical here is we're just starting to see signs of the Brewers messing around with Churio's playing time a little bit. There was a situation this week, Pat Murphy pinch hit Blake Perkins for Churio. And I was furious about it because Blake Perkins, like, why would you do that? So there's some stuff like that that gives you that little bit of, oh, are they going to send him down? Are they having doubts about him? The fact of the matter is the playing time situation for Jake Meyers, even though his skills growth this year looks legit, it's about to get more crowded because Chaz McCormick's going to come back. And I think you don't have an obvious platoon situation there. You could send down Joey Loperfido. You could try to play Loperfido at first. They're going to have Jose Abreu coming back soon to give him one last look at first base. So just the situation for Meyers is probably just as shaky right now, and you don't have that massive prospect payoff potential. The only other thing I would say for Churio, a lot more speed than we've seen from Meyers so far. I think you are getting the power speed with the low average from Jackson Churio so far. But if things start to click for him, there's upward mobility potential in that Brewers lineup. They're a team like the Rays. They mix and match, but he's one of their guys that they want to elevate if they're getting production.
you're absolutely right that the Brewers are heavily invested in Churio. And I don't just say that because of the extension that he signed, which is one of the reasons we all felt so great about his playing time this season. Shelley, I'm going to kick it to you for the Myers part of this.
Yeah, I, like DVR said, who thought that we'd be talking about this at this point of the season, these two players. What has impressed me about Myers is I watched a lot of the Astros games this weekend, and Myers was basically just hitting home runs. And I'm just like, wait, is this the guy for like 2 years? He's just been kind of eh, right? So then I go over to his Fangraphs page, and I'm like, oh, snap, right? He's hitting, like, he's what, nearly doubled his hard hit percentage. His barrel rate has gone up nearly 3 percentage points. His lunge angle is up too. So he's not just, it's not just hard hits into the ground. He is lofting the ball. So there is like some interesting, you know, bat to ball kind of stuff that's going on. And also his strikeout rate's gone from 25% to, you know, about 20%. So 5 percentage points off there. So just everything that I'm seeing from him, I'm just like, wow, this is like Chaz McCormick from last year. So maybe it's only like a 1 year thing because Chaz is not really produced and he's been injured. So if I had to pick one of these guys, it would be Myers going forward. I'm not going to drop Churio or whatever, but I think that with the Astros just struggling again, it's not really their hitting that's struggling. It's more of their pitching that's struggling, but they need to win games and Myers is hitting. And if McCormick is not hitting, if Lou Perfetto starts to turn, you know, make that rookie downward turn, right? I think Myers can scratch out close to full-time playing time with the Astros.
So there's two really different and interesting angles that I want to look at here for questions. And DVR, I'm going to start with you. You mentioned the rookies, the way rookies struggle when they come to the big leagues. I was actually just having this conversation over at Bleed Cubby Blue earlier today because people were asking about some of the rookies and the Cubs systems who have come up and really, really struggled at the major league level. And I think part of that is that pitching gap that you're talking about. Pretty much anyone who throws 95 with great stuff right now is in the majors. They're not in AAA, right? So like I know that Jackson Churio skipped AAA, but I don't think he would have learned much there because it's not like he could have faced the types of pitchers he's facing now in AAA. It's one of the reasons that you've got guys like Matt Mervis who look really great in AAA, and when they come up to the majors, they struggle mightily. I wonder how much of that just means that if you are going to invest in some of these rookie bats, one, do you want to do it their rookie season or do you want to wait until year two? Or two, do you have to give them a longer leash to see what is happening here? Because the gap between, hi, I spent most of my year in AA and now I'm facing guys who throw 99 and just absolutely wicked stuff is so big that it's impossible for a kid like Churio to deal with.
I think it's the latter. I think this is what your bench is generally for, right? So if you want to take the longer term investment and take a shot on a player that might not figure it out until June or July, or at least play at a level where you feel good about having him in your lineup every day until June or July, then you have to burn a bench spot that way. And maybe the strategy is saying, I drafted Wyatt Langford, I drafted Jackson Churio. I'm not going to take a chance on an injured pitcher that's coming back in May. I'm not going to, you know, do the other thing to shorten up my bench, right? We talk a lot about the NFBC and leagues that don't have any IL spots. Well, okay, you can burn one roster spot usually. And that's about as much as you can get away with, given the way injuries will find you and given the need to play matchups and sort of max out your playing time. So I think you just have to think about roster construction differently. I think the potential payoff is massive. Look what Julio Rodriguez did a couple of years ago. Look what Bobby Witt Jr. did at a higher ADP. Look what Ronald Acuna Jr. did his first year in the league. Like, and some of these guys are elite of elite prospects, and that's why they did it. But I think Langford and Churio deservedly fit into that bucket. I think when people analyze prospects, they tend to look back at other recent top-end guys and make sure that the tools line up. Not every top five prospect is equal, but I think both Langford and Churio were going through very normal struggles to begin the season, and now the window on Langford is even worse because of his injury. Now we have to wait even longer for him to come figure it out. So it just requires more patience to have players like this.
I think that's right. And I like what you said about using your bench in that way, because I don't think we think of those prospects as guys who are going to help our teams immediately. And sometimes they're not, but that doesn't mean they're not going to be great in come July or August. Shelley, I want to go a different route with my question for you. These are like two, we're in like diametrically opposed spheres here. The guy that Jake Myers reminds me a little bit of, not for positional reasons, but for the breakout, is Brandon Drury. And Brandon Drury was a league winner a couple of years ago. If you were able to go get Brandon Drury when he was having his breakout and you had the audacity to believe in it, 28-year-old guy who is probably going to play, who's doing all the things that we need him to do in the short term, and you're not investing in Jake Myers' long-term affairs. You're just investing in however many months he can give you this type of production. If I had Jake Myers on my team right now, which I don't anywhere, I'm heavily invested in Chaz McCormick, so this whole Jake Myers situation is a problem for me. But if I had Jake Myers anywhere, I'm writing this as long as it goes. Like, you didn't do anything other than spend some fab dollars to get him.
Exactly. I mean, you said Brandon Drury. I mean, I said Chaz McCormick. I mean, I did the same thing with Chaz last year. It was kind of like a lot of people were like, this is not believable. Where did this come from? La, 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 la. But at the end of the season, it was great production. I think you can, obviously, if you picked up Myers, you know, good for you, you know, but just ride it out until the playing time shifts. He kind of makes a turn for the worst or whatever. But if you picked him up, just keep going. And sadly, bench Jackson Chourio.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably hurt you a little bit if you have to bench Jackson Chourio for Jake Myers, but that is the right redraft decision maybe at this point in time. Although you definitely don't, I'm going to agree with DVR here. You don't want to cut bait on a talent like Jackson Chourio, particularly given how much the Brewers want him to succeed. I think he's going to get a lot of opportunities because of that. You each have 1 minute to rebut each other if you have rebuttals.
I mean, I think I'll help make a case for Jake Myers with my minute, just because he's doing enough things well that he is taking advantage of this opportunity and possibly extending it. You could play McCormick in left and Myers in center. That world completely exists. It becomes a question of McCormick versus Lo Profito. And Lo Profito has options. Lo Profito's striking out a lot, even though the production's been fine. So I think the answer is going to be they play together, and the Astros found another, you know, value, a 13th round pick back in 2017 that's turning into a good player in his late 20s. He's 90th percentile in sprint speed. So Jake Myers could start stealing bases. That wouldn't be all that surprising. He's their best defensive option right now in center field, I think, by outs above average. That's going to drive some playing time. So I think, hey, like, if I could have both of these guys on my roster, both Myers and Jackson Chourio, no problem. Just make it happen. If you got to choose one or the other, I'll get burned by this, but I'll take Chourio. I think there's still just too much ceiling there to give up on him now.
Shelley, your rebuttal.
Yeah, I totally hear that. I have Chourio in one league, and I've had him benched for 2 weeks, and I'm always tempted to put him into my active lineup, but I'm just like, I need to see something before I put him in there. For Myers, it's just, I just love everything that he's doing, and he's hitting decently high in the Astros lineup, you know, about fifth or sixth. And again, he's playing every day. Chourio is not currently. He might, by this time next month, he totally could be playing every day, and Myers could not. But for right now, it's no question Myers, 100%.
That was an interesting discussion, because I think that we don't talk about prospects in redraft from this perspective a lot. We want them to succeed. And honestly, the time comes where the journeyman 28-year-old that might just have to take that spot. And that doesn't mean you cut bait on the prospect, but it may be a little bit painful, especially if it's a guy you believe in. I've got a lot of Wyatt Langford this year. I believe in Wyatt Langford, and just staring at him on my bench right now. We are going to take one more quick break for our sponsors. On the flip side, we have one last debate, couple of late round or maybe even fab pickup pitchers, and then we'll do our love it or leave it. Stick around.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you gotta check out NexGard Plus, ofoxaconazole, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease, plus it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious beef-flavored, soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive.
If your small business is booming, you might say,
cha-ching!
But you should say,
like a good neighbor, State Farm is there!
And we'll help your growing business. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Give your home a beautiful makeover with flooring options from Menards. Update your room with flooring from Tarkett. From easy-to-install sheet vinyl, waterproof vinyl plank, to durable laminate flooring, Tarkett has the perfect style for you. Grovewood laminate flooring is stain, scratch, and dent resistant and designed with busy families in mind. Save big money on our wide variety of flooring options in-store or on Menards.com for more great deals now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
All right, we are back. So Seth Lugo and Luis Gil both were outstanding over the weekend. And frankly, both have been pretty outstanding this season. Lugo went 5 2/3 with 10 strikeouts against Oakland, while Gil pitched 6 innings with 14 strikeouts. They're both very different. But if you had to pick one rest of season, are you investing in Seth Lugo or are you investing in Luis Gil? Derek, as our guest, you get to kick us off.
Full betrayal of my podcast co-host, Eno Saris, who was telling anybody who would listen and even people who didn't want to listen to have Seth Lugo on their team this year. I mean, he was before Lugo signed, every episode of the show featured a team that should sign Seth Lugo. We were up to 12 teams that should have added Seth Lugo, which based on results, hey, great call, Eno. The main thing here is that I look at Luis Gil and I see that extra gear in terms of strikeout potential. And I chase that. In pitching, I need that extra juice. Now, I think Yankees versus Royals, there's a team context difference here, too. I like the Yankees pen better. I like the Yankees run support better, similar to some of the stuff we talked about earlier in the show, just between Glasnow and Skubal. So that extra notch of team support, team context matters as well. The biggest difference, though, this season with Luis Gil, he has a changeup now, and he's throwing it kind of a lot. So he's not just fastball slider. He's fastball slider changeup. He does have shaky control and command, so you're going to see some occasional big walk totals sprinkled in. But I think he's kind of in that effectively wild category. He has slightly better command than the guys like the Edward Cabreras that never quite put it all together over a full stretch. And there's a clear need here. I mean, I think the way Luis Gil temporarily loses his job is Gerrit Cole comes back healthy, and even then the Yankees could consider a six-man rotation, or one of the other frequently injured starters in that rotation will be hurt then too. So I do think there's a good chance he holds a starting spot. I think the way they pushed Clark Schmidt last year innings wise gives us a little bit of a template for how hard they would push Luis Gil as the season rolls along. You're probably looking at 140, 150 innings in the regular season as an actual attainable target. You're not going to get a 2.39 ERA. You're not going to get a 108 whip the rest of the way, but Steamers got him down to 373 and a 128. The bats got him at 382 and 125. You don't usually see agreement like that between those two projection systems. I'm here for it because those Ks on top of those ratios would make him probably a top 30 starter the rest of the way, at least on a per start basis.
Yeah, I am very into what Luis Gil is doing. Part of it's the changeup. Part of it is just, I picked him up in a couple of leagues off the waiver wire in that first Fab run. And I was nervous because anytime you got a new kid in Yankee Stadium, that can go poorly. And he just has not shown any nerves at all. So I'm the only thing I'm worried about is that Luis Gil might not have a rotation spot at some point in time. But usually injuries have a way of taking care of that. Shelley, take the Seth Lugo side of this one.
Yeah, I'm going to take the boring veteran here. I will definitely concede that Gil is definitely going to get you more strikeouts if they throw the same amount of innings going forward. I just don't think that's going to happen. As we've already said, Gerrit Cole's coming back. Yes, they can go to a sixth man, but is Gerrit Cole going to be okay with that after like two starts? Like, he just seems like the guy who's going to be like, no, I pitch every fifth day. Aaron Boone, you figure this out kind of thing. So at some point, unless someone else gets injured, which again, can totally happen, he might lose his spot. He might have to go to the bullpen. He might go back to the minors. Who knows? That's what scares me. Seth Lugo, unless he gets hurt, he's not going to lose his job. The Kansas City is just going to let him pitch. He's going to go six innings, seven innings with consistency. And yeah, it might be like a four strikeout game, a five strikeout game over six or seven innings, which again, just looking at stat lines, not that sexy. But he's going to be in the hunt for wins if he goes six, seven innings consistently. Because Kansas City, they have a pretty good offense. It surprised me how well they have been performing. So he has, like, wins are extremely fluky, but he has, like, this extra boost of Kansas City's going to let him go enough, like, long enough to reach that. I don't know if he'll will. Like, if he starts to get, you know, roughed up in like the third inning or something, the Yankees have a phenomenal bullpen. Aaron Boone will just yank him out and go to all the, you know, fire throwing relievers, just try to win a game. So going forward, yeah, he's probably going to beat you in strikeouts, but everything else, I think it's in Lugo's hands.
Shelley, you mentioned something interesting about the Kansas City offense, which I agree. Like, I have been kind of surprised because, frankly, I can't figure out where the offense is coming from. Michael Garcia hasn't really had the breakout we thought he was going to. I am on the record as saying that I think Nelson Velasquez is a 30 home run bat, and he's going to have to hit a lot of home runs in the warm months to catch up to that after a slow start. Somehow the offense is there anyway. Are you, you know, to throw back to what we were talking about with Skubal and Glasnow earlier, are you worried about the wins with Lugo at all?
I mean, not really. I mean, I just think that he's just going to be a set it and forget it type of guy. I mean, yeah, if he goes into, like, I don't know, has to go face the Dodgers or something. I mean, I don't know if he's going to play the Dodgers this year. But if he has to face like a big time, you know, scary offense, then yeah, maybe I'll sit him. But I don't think he's going to kill you in any type of game, right? He's not going to have, most likely, he's not going to have like a six, seven earned run outing on his ledger. There might be a couple of bad hiccups, but I don't think it's going to be pretty much just steady production.
Fair enough. And then DVR, you know, looking at Luis Gil, and I agree with you. I love the strikeout potential for Gil, and I like what he's been doing. I do worry a little bit that part of what Shelley's talking about in terms of the investment, in terms of the amount of innings that they will let Seth Lugo throw versus the amount of innings they will let Luis Gil throw. If I'm looking at this right, he threw four innings in a ball last year and 25 innings in the minors and majors prior to that. How many more innings does Luis Gil have left this season?
I think I've always used the previous career high as your kind of your anchor point. It's not based on anything other than that seems to be what many teams do, but that's from the outside looking in. Main thing for me would be that you've seen 96 innings, I think, in 2019 as the high watermark. Actually, maybe a little more in 2021. It was split over three levels, double A, triple A, and the big league. So like low three figures, like 110, 115. So between that and then using comps like Schmidt being in a similar situation, Clark Schmidt missed a ton of time with injuries in the Yankees system, and they pushed him pretty hard. And I think some of it is the age, right? You get to a certain point, you hit your mid-20s, and teams say, you know what? Let's just see if you can hold up. We're just going to go for it. If you hold up, great. You're one of our people. You're in the rotation. You're important to us. If you break again, you're in the bullpen or you're on the injured list, and that's just the way it is. It's sad, but it seems to be the way that teams kind of handle the pitching prospects once they hit a certain age. So I'm not completely worried about it. I do think the way they could use him is to consistently get him out before he faces the lineup a third time because of their bullpen depth. That would hurt his chances at wins. The other way I would try to think about Luis Gil, arguing against myself now because that's fun, take away the 14K start. Like, take away the outlier. That's an amazing performance. It counts. It's in the ledger. But before that, how did you feel about Luis Gil? Like, I think this is the generally smart way to think about players. If you see something amazing, rewind. Go back. See what you thought the player was before that performance. And that sort of grounds you a little bit in terms of who they are as players. With Luis Gil, he was running a 186 BABIP before that 14K performance. Nobody runs a 186 BABIP as a starter. The FIP was over a run higher than the ERA. So it just helps you remember, yeah, this is a good over a strikeout per inning guy, but maybe it's not a 12, 13 Ks per nine sort of starter either in Luis Gil. I just think he'll make up the difference that Lugo gets on volume by striking more guys out, even when you adjust accordingly for Luis Gil. It's a great toss-up because sometimes the older, more boring player is the better player. It's why Shelley's a great fantasy player, because she'll take a chance on Lugo instead of the shiny new toy that might have a higher ceiling, but also could crash and burn or lose a share of his role at some point.
It's a really interesting point. I'm actually looking at Luis Gil's game logs right now, and I've been happy with Luis Gil. The thing that jumps out at me, aside from, you're right, that 14 strikeout outing is definitely an outlier. He went 4 2/3. He went 4 1/3. Then he had like a month where they let him go 5. Then he has like a month where they let him go 6. And it really does sort of look like they're trusting him more, not less. So I think I might have just answered my own innings concern there as well. You each have 1 minute for a rebuttal if you choose to use them. DVR, you go first.
I mean, Seth Lugo, my only concern about him is that he spent a few years in the bullpen, stretched back out last year, was legitimately a guy I had forgotten about. When the Padres signed him, he popped up as a starter early last season. And I had a genuine moment of, oh, that's right. He ended up in San Diego and, oh, they're going to use him as a regular starter all season. He held up for 146 in a third innings last year. There's no reason to back off a 34-year-old. If he's healthy, he's going to keep pitching. So the ceiling is probably in the 180 range, or maybe there's no ceiling at all. I'm wondering what the injury risk is for a guy like him after going so long without pushing the workload the way he did last year.
It's a great point. Shelley, your rebuttal.
Yeah, just give me length and quality. Someone who's not going to hurt you. That's going to be Lugo. I hate going to the waiver wire. I hate streaming. I really do. It bothers me because it always blows up in my face. And with guys like Lugo, those are the kind of guys that I like to get like as my fourth, fifth starter, because you don't have to worry about him, you know, losing his job or whatever. Yeah, it's not going to be as much fun as Heels, you know, what, 14K game. Like, it's nothing. It's not going to be fun like that. You're not going to be like, ooh la la, I got Seth Lugo on my team. Look at me. No, you're never going to be like that. But you're just, at the end of the season, you're like, oh yeah, Lugo's the guy who helped me win, take my title. So give me the old boring veteran.
Listen, I am here for old boring veterans. I've got a lot of Martin Perez this year, although that did not work out well. The Martin regression, Perez regression, when it hits hard and immediately. And you're like, oh yes, that's why he was available at that point in the draft. We're going to move on to the end of our show. DVR, before we do that, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you? Where can they find your work? We really appreciate you joining us on Fantasy Feud in our inaugural season.
Yeah, thank you both for having me on. I'm still on Twitter, even though I don't really want to be, just at Derek Van Riper. But I try to spend more time. We have a Rates and Barrels Discord now, so if you want to join that, we have links to that in our podcast show description. Individual team channels, fantasy channels. We have one channel called The Void, so if you're just mad about something, you can just put it out there and get it off your chest and go on with your day. So it's fun hanging out in there, finding that our listeners are good people to hang with. So. That's where I spend most of my time on social these days. I've got some updated hitter rankings coming out probably the end of next week. So we got that to look forward to as well. But yeah, the Rates and Barrels podcast is the main show I'm a part of now.
Good stuff. And yeah, the Discord, the Rates and Barrels Discord is great. You should also be in the Pitcher List Discord. And if you are not, make sure you join that, because that's a fun place as well. We are going to end the show the way we always do, with our love it or leave it. One thing from baseball news this week that we are into and or over. DVR, you get to kick us off.
I'll take Christian Yelich stealing home on Monday night on the throw back to the pitcher. It was Nick Fortes was behind the plate, and he was just in a both knees flat on the ground, lollipop the throw back to Ryan Weathers, and Yelich caught him and stole home on him, and looked like he might have got a cleat in there in a bad spot too, which I don't think he was trying to do. Just added insult to an embarrassing play for Nick Fortes. But I love base running stuff like that. I mean, even when Ellie De La Cruz stole home against the Brewers last year, that was an awesome play. It's one of those things that it's kind of gone by the wayside with the new rules. Maybe it's coming back a little bit. When you find teams doing different things with their catchers like that, take advantage of it. I love it.
Yeah, stealing home is one of the best plays in baseball. It's one of the reasons The Sandlot is such a great movie, because you've got the stealing home montage at the end. Anyway, I won't ruin it for anyone who has to see The Sandlot. But yeah, Yelich stealing home is good stuff. And I can say that as a Cubs fan. Shelly, what's your love it or leave it this week?
Yeah, I'm gonna go negative. I'm tired of these lame, boring City Connect jerseys that have been coming out this year. Like when it first started, I was really excited. They seemed like really good. Like the Washington one's good. San Diego's is fire. Just, they were like a lot of good ones. And this year I've just been just like, they're so boring. Like Cleveland's came out, I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And to me, I didn't notice anything different other than it right here on the chest. It said something different and the hat looked different. I'm like, okay. And then over the weekend, St. Louis's came out and I'm like, one, it looks exactly the same, right? It's still got the bat, it got two cardinals, whatever, it's still red. And then they had the audacity, or they were just, I don't know. It says the loo, and all I can think of is it's a toilet. That's what it is. I'm like, did no one in St. Louis think about this? You have the toilet written across your chest. So I'm just like, where's the creativity? Like, I could have thought of something better, and I am not a creative person at all. I would not put the toilet across the chest. I'm tired of it.
I just want to point out that I am a Cubs fan and DVR is a Brewers fan, and Shelly is the one that went to town on the Cardinal City Connect jerseys. We didn't even have to do it. Like, non-NL Central people see how bad this was. My personal favorite about that, Mason Wynn was asked about these jerseys. I believe it was Mason Wynn. He was like, well, they're City Connects. Yes, they are. Can't even make a statement about the new jerseys. Just like, they exist.
They are, in fact, a City Connect. Yeah, I love it when players don't want to tell the truth, but they do it in their own way like that. That's perfect. That's all we need. I mean, there's a few good ones. I like the Nats cherry blossom ones, and I guess they're not wearing them after this season, which is weird.
I'm so upset. So upset.
Those should just, they should just use those all the time. And the one that I find the most annoying, the Giants ones, at least the kind of like the older one that's been around for a few years. I can't stand the Giants ones with the fog. Like, I get why you tried to do that. They wear them all the time. And maybe it's because I'm getting old and my eyes are kind of crappy at night. But if you're at the game, you can't really see the numbers real good. And I don't know. It's silly. But give me a 2 thumbs up on the cherry blossom. Send me a Victor Robles one and I'll wear it. I asked Britt Giroli, because she's, you know, on Tuesday Rates and Barrels with us and she lives in that area. I'm like, hey, if you ever see a Victor Robles cherry blossoms jersey, you know, anywhere, TJ Maxx, Marshalls, full price, I don't care. I want it. Please get it for me. I will get you the money and I'll have the best possible jersey, but I haven't seen it and I'm not going to customize one. That's going too far.
So you heard it here, people. If there's a Washington National City Connect for Victor Robles, DVR is your guy.
I'll take it.
I'm going to go positive here because I saw something in Wrigleyville this past week that I've literally never seen. I've lived in this neighborhood since 2015, so I've lived here for the golden age of Cubs baseball, but I've been in and around and in and out, you know, to visit, to watch Cubs games since the early 2000s. And I have never seen the Wrigley Field marquee say anything other than the pitching matchup and the time the game starts. Like Brewers v Cubs 120. That's it. Like that's all it says. That's what it says when it's the World Series. That's what it says when Jake Arrieta is pretending that he's the greatest pitcher set this side of lowering the mound. That's what it says. Period. The end. It doesn't say Jake Day. It doesn't say anything. Saturday, when I went to Wrigley Field, the marquee said Showtime 120. I don't know what Shota Umaga is doing to this team and like what is going on in Wrigleyville, but this man has not thrown 10 starts for the Chicago Cubs, and he's already changing how the marquee presents the game to fans, which is something that I never thought I would see. And this is special, y'all. Like Wrigleyville is a neighborhood built around baseball in a way that very few places in this country are. And for Shota to have that kind of impact on a team with that type of history and for the Cubs to lean into it this way is going to be super fun. So I hope he keeps it up. Certainly kept it up on Saturday, but it is Showtime in Wrigleyville and I'm here for it.
I kind of want the Brewers to face him soon so that way they can get a look at him before too long. My main thing with Shota is going to be like his fastball has so much ride and it's not a high velo fastball. Is this going to be the best stretch of a very good career in the big leagues? Or is this the sign of the start of a career for someone who has started a career, at least in Major League Baseball, for someone that the league missed on? I don't know. But I just think as teams get to see him more, we'll have a better sense of how much of it is like deception and just the lack of familiarity with that pitch and how much of it is like his ability to be maybe a special pitcher.
It's a really great question. And I did a piece for earlier this week for Bleed Cubby Blue that looked at Shota's start versus Fernando Valenzuela's start in 1981 and just sort of some of the similarities, some of the differences. Obviously, Valenzuela threw like 8 complete games to start his career. That will never happen again because we live in a wholly different world now. But there are some similarities. They both come at you from a weird angle. They both do some weird little hesitation things. They both kind of have this delivery that's very different than what you normally see. And I wonder how much Shota might benefit from the fact that the new schedule means that when the Brewers finally see Shota, and it looks like it's going to happen a week from Wednesday in Milwaukee, at least according to the RotoWire probable pitchers grid, it might be a minute before the Brewers see him again, right? Like no team has seen Shota twice yet. And that's even with the Cubs playing the Pirates and the Braves back to back. They just haven't seen him twice. And so it might be the middle of July before a team gets their second crack at him. And I wonder how much you can time a fastball that doesn't move the way you expect it to, or a splitter that comes out of a perfect tunnel when you haven't seen it for a month and a half. It'll be really interesting to see. I have no idea. All right, Shelley, what are you doing this week and what are you watching for in baseball before we head out to finish up our Tuesday evenings here?
Yeah, I don't know. I just been just watching baseball, just enjoying it. I'm going to a concert on Thursday, which I'm really looking forward to. Because I have kind of stopped writing about baseball, I actually have time to go to concerts. So I have like 4 or 5 like already have tickets for, and I'm really looking forward to just getting out there and just having fun. So that's what I'll be doing. But yeah, I've just last weekend just watched baseball, just having fun, just watching games.
As you should. And I hope the concert is amazing. You can find my Cubs writing at Bleed Cubby Blue. You can find my fantasy baseball writing at Baseball HQ, TVR from The Athletic. Thank you again so much for joining us. Be sure you check out the Rates and Barrels Discord. Be sure you check out the Pitcher List Discord. We'll be back next week with all of the biggest debates from fantasy baseball. Be sure you are subscribed so you never miss an episode, and join us then. Till then.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, a Foxaloner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give.
Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.